Over the weeks of his exile, Jonesy explained how the neuronal analysis equipment used neutrino scans to see which parts of the octopod's brains were activated when they communicated with one another. "And that works underwater?" Brad had asked. With a wry smile, Jonesy replied, "The neutrinos go through the seawater as if it wasn't there. The big trick with neutrinos is to get a few of them to register on your receiving equipment." Little by little, Brad learned how the analysis system compared the octopod's brain activity to the actions they took, how certain flurries of neural sparks were connected to activities. "Connecting neural excitement to abstract concepts is much more difficult," Jonesy told Brad, his computer-generated face looking grave, concerned. "But with enough sampling, it can be done. Tentatively, of course." "Of course," said Brad. The octopods didn't seem to mind the strange objects that had appeared in the ocean among them. At first, they had assailed the probes with intense chattering, then approached the devices and touched them with their tentacles. Within a few days, they were ignoring the alien probes that floated alongside them and went about their business as if they didn't exist. Brad concluded, "They've decided that the probes aren't dangerous and they're not food." That's where their curiosity ends, I guess. But as his understanding of the octopod's language grew, he learned differently. The probes swam along with a swarm of octopods, powered by nuclear generators capable of running for years. They regularly sent bursts of audio information to the ocean's surface, where the acoustic waves were detected by mini-satellites that dipped into the planet's atmosphere briefly to pick up the signals. The mini-sats, in turn, relayed the data they received to the shuttlecraft. The octopods avoided those data bursts. Within the first few days, they learned to move out of the way whenever the probes sent their messages toward the surface of the sea. They learned pretty quickly, Brad realized. Probably the intense audio bursts are painful to them. "Pain makes man think," Brad recalled from somewhere in his childhood. "Thought makes man wise." "So they say," Brad told himself. "So they say." Brad's dream. Brad drifted into his sleeping compartment and stared at the mesh cocoon hanging limply against one of the bulkheads. He had put off trying to sleep for as long as he could, forcing himself to stay awake even when his eyelids grew as heavy as anvils. He knew that if he slept, he would dream. The same dream. Its details changed now and then, but it was always the same. Now, so weary that, as he hung weightlessly in the middle of the narrow sleep compartment, fighting against his body's need for sleep, he knew that his struggle was futile. Sooner or later, he would fall asleep. Better to succumb in the zero-G cocoon than while trying to operate the ship's systems. He had thought of asking the ship's doctors back on Odysseus for some medication that would block out the dream. But that would mean explaining why he was troubled, and he'd end up being examined by the psychiatrists, or worse, being taken off duty entirely. And he certainly didn't want Kossoff to know about his problem. So, wearily, he peeled off his coveralls and popped them into the washer, then slid into the mesh cocoon and zippered it up to his chin. He commanded the lights to shut down, then stared into the enveloping darkness. Totally dark, except for the unblinking red light at the base of the comm console. "Just like my room at Tithonium. Dark. Black as night. Dark as death." The dream always began the same way. He was jarred from his sleep by a rumbling, growling sound, like some alien beast snarling at him. 14-year-old Brad sat up in his bed. Mom and Dad were in the next room, he knew. Davy was in the bed next to his own. The room was shaking, and somehow Brad was outside, out in the open, wearing a pressure suit and helmet, standing on the floor of Tithonium Chasma, and it was bright daylight. The wall of the canyon rose up, a serrated, sheer scarp that ran more than 1,000 kilometers in either direction. Atop the rim, the Martian sky was a dull butterscotch yellow-brown. Suddenly, a streak of fire blazed across that sky. A meteor, young Brad understood. A big one. It roared terrifyingly as it disappeared over the canyon rim and exploded. The concussion knocked Brad off his feet, and the red, rock-strewn ground beneath him was shaking, trembling as if some invisible, gigantic, monstrous hand was shaking it. Pebbles skittered and jittered as Brad climbed shakily to his booted feet. Pressure-suited people were running away from the crumbling chasm wall. Rocks were tumbling down the scarp, some as big as houses. They fell slowly, almost leisurely in the low Martian gravity, but still smashed whatever they hit as they struck the chasm floor. Brad saw one of the hothouse buildings crushed as a boulder flattened it. "Mom and Dad and Davy are still inside the housing complex." Brad stood in an agony of indecision. "What should I do? What should I do?"
"Hey, you! Don't just stand there!" one of the construction crewmen's voices screamed in Brad's helmet earphones. "Grab a tractor and pick up as many people as you can!"
"I don't know how to run a tractor," Brad wanted to answer. "I've never been allowed inside one." But whoever had yelled at him had run off to help others. Brad's height had fooled him. In the helmeted pressure suit, he had assumed that Brad was an adult. He ran to an idle tractor and climbed into its cockpit. Gasping, his heart racing, Brad looked over the controls, then punched the big red button that started the engine. Looking up, he saw the whole wall of rock crumbling, falling, smashing the puny human buildings at its base. The tractor lurched into motion. Brad tried to steer it, but didn't know how. The machine seemed to have a mind of its own. People were rushing away from the buildings, away from the killing rocks tumbling down the wall. Brad saw bodies sprawled everywhere. Men and women and children who had bolted outside without sealing their pressure suits. Some of them didn't even have their helmets on. Their faces had exploded in blood. Brad couldn't control the tractor. It plowed ahead, rolling over bodies living and dead, until it bumped to a stop against the remains of what had been the building where Brad and his family had been quartered. Horrified, Brad looked down from his perch in the tractor and saw Mom, Dad, and Davy staring up at him, dead and accusing. "Why didn't you help us? Why did you let us die?" And Brad was struggling in his sleep cocoon, writhing inside its mesh confines, his eyes blinded with tears, his mind screaming with memories. He tore at the cocoon's zipper and sailed out of the cocoon, banging his shoulder painfully against the far bulkhead of the narrow compartment. For long moments he hung there in a fetal crouch in the darkness, slowly drifting across the chamber, gasping for air. It hadn't happened the way his dream showed it. He had been outside, of course, fully suited up, but he had never taken a tractor. Panting, doubled over as he hung in midair, Brad muttered to himself, "There was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could do." Yet the reality was that he survived the catastrophe without a scratch, while his family was killed. He had had another argument with his father, over what Brad couldn't remember, but he'd bolted from the breakfast table, grabbed his camera, ran down to the airlock and pulled on a pressure suit, then gone outside. Away from his father, away from the whole family. He had to get away from them. "I was outside, taking pictures of the chasm wall when it happened," Brad remembered. "I should have been inside having breakfast with my family, but I couldn't sit down with them. I went outside. I left them to be crushed to death while I went out to take fucking pictures. I let them die. I should have died with them." Every time Brad had the dream, he awoke with the same overwhelming sense of guilt. He had gone through more than a year of intense psychotherapy. He had learned to control the guilt during the day. Sometimes he actually forgot it. Almost. Eventually, he earned a degree in anthropology from the Distance Learning University of Mars. When the call went out for volunteers to participate in the star missions to save alien civilizations threatened by the death wave, Brad signed up. Atonement might be found in a flight to another star. He had nothing to lose, nothing to leave behind except his memories. But even 200 light years away from Mars, he had to sleep. And sooner or later, he would dream. And the awful sense of guilt and shame would crush him the way the tumbling rocks of Tithonium Chasma had crushed his mother, father, and little brother. Conversations. "I'm going to try to talk to the octopods," Brad said to the image of Jonesy on the tutorial program's screen.
Jonesy's eyes narrowed slightly. Do you think that's wise? Brad was in the shuttlecraft's tightly packed communications center, surrounded by consoles and screens. He always thought of the comm center as an all-seeing eye, searching everywhere, never sleeping. It was tight in there, especially for a gangling young man of Brad's height. He was always bumping an elbow or banging a knee against the jam-packed instruments. Hovering weightlessly in front of the tutorial screen, Brad replied, "We've built up a mini-dictionary of their terms. In another week, I'll be going back to Odysseus. I want to bring some positive results back with me. Have you gotten approval from Dr. Littlejohn?" "I haven't told him yet." "As I understand your mission guidelines, you should get your department head's approval before attempting contact with the aliens." Brad knew that Jonesy was right. "He knows Kossoff's routine better than I do," Brad thought. "And he never forgets anything." "What do you hope to accomplish?" Jonesy asked. "Making meaningful contact with an alien species," Brad snapped. "Isn't that worthwhile?"
"Not if it harms the aliens."
Brad realized he was floating away from the screen when his rump hit the corner of the neural analyzer's console. Slightly flustered, he pushed himself back toward Jonesy's image. "How can it harm them?" Jonesy shrugged his slim shoulders. "We don't know anything about their understanding of the world they live in. It seems unlikely that they know anything about the universe outside of their ocean. Your sudden intrusion into their world could upset them, cause them harm." Shaking his head so hard that he started drifting away from the screen again, Brad countered, "Look, they accustomed themselves to the probes we've placed among them. What's the harm in saying hello to them? I'm an engineering program, not a psych system. But mission protocol specifically says that attempts to make contact with an alien species have to be approved by the highest scientific authority." "Kossoff," Brad growled. "Professor Kossoff is the chief of this mission. You'll have to get his permission before you try to contact the octopods." "And if I don't?" Jonesy shrugged again. "As you yourself have complained many times, Professor Kossoff doesn't like you. Going around him and making contact on your own isn't going to improve his attitude toward you." Brad knew that Jonesy was right. Still, "Talk to Dr. Littlejohn, at least," the image on the screen suggested. "Yeah, maybe you're right," Brad muttered, reluctantly. "My contact with him?" Littlejohn was startled by the idea. He was sitting at his desk in his office aboard Odysseus, a small compartment next to his living quarters. Brad McDaniels's earnest, almost combative face filled his desktop screen. Aware of the 3-minute communications lag between them, Littlejohn went on. "Actual contact with an alien species has to be okayed by Kossoff and the executive committee. You're not authorized to make that decision on your own." But Brad was already saying, "The octopods have tolerated having our probes swimming among them. They haven't shown the slightest reaction to our probing their brains, although I guess they don't even realize that we're beaming neutrino probes at them. It would be an incredibly important step, making meaningful contact with them." Littlejohn shook his head sternly. "No, no, no. You can't do it. You mustn't. Not until Kossoff okays it." And then he waited for Brad's reply. But he thought he knew what the headstrong young man would say. At last, Brad's words reached him. "All right. Ask Kossoff. But I've only got another week to stay here before I return to Odysseus. Get Kossoff to make up his mind quickly." As an afterthought, Brad added, "Please." Brad's comm screen went dark. Littlejohn's scared to death, he thought. He's afraid of getting on Kossoff's bad side, as if the bastard has a good side. Turning weightlessly toward the tutorial screen, Brad said to Jonesy's image, "I'm going to set up a communications link with the probes down there. I want to be ready the instant Kossoff gives the go-ahead." "If he gives you the go-ahead," Jonesy cautioned,